Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is August 10th, 2005. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. And with me again tonight are Perry DeAngelis.
Hey, hello.
Bob Novella.
Hello.
And Evan Bernstein.
Salutations.
So our president is up to it again. In the last few days, he made a comment essentially saying that he endorses the teaching of intelligent design alongside evolution in public schools, essentially echoing the position of the intelligent design proponents to teach the controversy that kids will be best served if they hear both sides of the issue. And he also, in the same interview, professed his own personal belief that God created the world. I'm sure you guys have heard this about this quite a bit in the past week.
Yeah, yes. Steve, I've heard a lot about it. That last piece I'm not too familiar with. Because I carefully scrutinized his wording, and it was a little ambiguous, you know, teaching the controversy, not specifically saying, let's put this in the science classes side by side with evolution. Now, he probably believes that, but he didn't say that. But what did he say about, God creating the earth? Did you have a quote in front of you?
Yes. The quote is, I personally believe God created the earth.
But wait a minute. The president disavowed evolution? That's the question. The Catholic Church believes God created the earth. They also believe in evolution. Has the president disavowed evolution?
But Catholics aren't creationists.
So what? That's still a key question. It's a key question. Does the president believe or does he not believe in evolution?
I've not seen or heard any quotes that he specifically says evolution didn't happen. Your point is well taken that, you know, he could be a theological evolutionist.
Right.
There's a whole spectrum from young earth creationists who think that, you know, God created the world 10,000 years ago and no evolution of any kind occurred, to sort of deistic evolutionists who believe completely that all life evolved over billions of years from just cells and proteins
in
the primordial soup, but that God guided the process.
You know, even if the president does believe in evolution, even if it's a theological question to him, this is still, you know, a serious problem in President Bush's makeup. The guy is, he's almost a religious zealot. It's a real problem.
It's a problem for the president of the free world. Yeah, absolutely.
It absolutely is, and this is a tremendously dark spot on his record, in my opinion.
And it goes hand in hand with his stance against stem cell research and his faith-based initiative. I mean, this is clearly part of his overall agenda.
I hope the Congress is going to bulldoze his stem cell legislation. I hope they're going to bowl over it.
Guys, I heard a great quote. 9/11 was a faith-based initiative.
Yeah.
Although not the kind of faith that Bush endorses.
Yeah, another black hole. Faith-based initiatives. I mean, they're an outrage. Separation of church and state. You know, it's whenever the president and the government nears religion, he veers off course.
Right.
He really veers off course. I mean, it's bad. It's bad.
And it's not only the violation of separation of church and state. Regardless of what you think about the religious aspects of intelligent design, even if, you know, the intelligent design proponents are often coy in saying that they're not talking about God, it's just some kind of generic intelligent designer. They're careful to remove anything overtly religious from their writings. But even if we give them a pass on that sort of coyness, it still is true that intelligent design is not a scientific theory. It's not a scientific theory because it cannot be tested. It's not testable.
It's not
falsifiable. And the proponents don't do anything that even resembles actual science.
That's the bottom line, right? It's not science.
So it does not belong in science classrooms.
Right. Teach it in Sunday school, not biology.
You know, the one, the most compelling thing that the intelligent design people and, you know, and Bush, you know, echoing their sentiments, have to say is to sort of teach the controversy. Again, I don't think that intelligent design should be taught as science in a science classroom. But I certainly endorse people knowing why intelligent design is not science and using it as an example of
right.
of logical fallacies and of you know, sort of pathological science. How could we do that without teaching intelligent design or without sort of violating the principle of separation of church and state? I would guess perhaps by teaching it more in a logic or philosophy class, not a science class as science. So that position sounds very reasonable, fair, and compelling. You know, really, unless you understand that it's not science, which I think your average person probably does not.
Right.
It's hard to see the flaw in that argument. So I think that Bush is very politically savvy enough to realize that his statements would probably be looked upon favorably by most Americans.
And the certainly his constituency.
Polls certainly indicate that. And certainly the vast majority of his constituency, yes.
Has any reporter done any follow-up with this, or is it just pretty much died right there and nothing further? No one's brought this up saying, hey, could you expand on this point? Nobody said anything, have they?
Yeah, no, the Democrats haven't picked it up.
Yeah, I really haven't heard a lot about it.
No, they haven't picked it up. They're not running with it. I think they think it's dangerous.
They could, and
right.
they could.
They feel
alienated enough from the religious part of
their cost benefit analysis is not favorable on this one.
That's right. They need to move on to other. More productive things as far as they're concerned.
But on a somewhat of a lighter note, Bush's science advisor, John Marburger III, differed from the president, and he wrote that intelligent design is not a scientific theory, basically hitting the key point on the head.
Thank goodness.
I don't know what that means to White House policy, but at least his science advisor understands the issue, at least as far as that statement is concerned.
Amen.
Well, why don't we transition from that to science or fiction?
It's time to play Science or Fiction.
This is a weekly segment. Each week I will come up with three either science news items or science facts. Two of them are genuine, and one is fictitious. One is made up. And I challenge my skeptical colleagues to figure out which one is fake.
Challenge accepted.
All right, so there's a theme to the three items this week. The theme is historical figures with medical ailments. I'm going to give you three historical figures and a disease that they are alleged to have had. I'll warn you ahead of time that the disease may not have been absolutely proven, meaning that there was not a biological, pathological diagnosis made at the time. Some of these diagnoses may have been made by reviewing historical documents.
Okay.
But the two that are real, I would say that the historical evidence is very compelling. I would say greater than 90%, in my opinion.
Okay.
So not ironclad fact, but very, very likely. And
great
one I just completely made up. So one, in fact, has no reality to it whatsoever.
All right.
You guys ready?
I bet Napoleon's in there somewhere.
Nope. No Napoleon.
I think Lou Gehrig's going to be in there somewhere.
Good one.
Thank you.
What did he have again, Lou Gehrig?
he had Babe Ruth disease.
Babe Ruth disease. I'll give you an example, one I'm not going to include. Like, for example, that many physicians believe that Joan of Arc had a form of right temporal lobe epilepsy.
True.
During these epileptic seizures, people will often have religious
epiphanies.
Visions or experiences. So it's possible that some of her description of the visions and episodes that she had may have, in fact, been just right temporal lobe seizures, and people with that form of epilepsy have what is known as hyper-religiosity. They are very religious people. So that's more in the realm of speculation, but it's in sort of interesting speculation about her.
Well, Steve, that's a very interesting point, because I think it's very very intriguing that there's actually a part of your brain that induces these intense religious experiences. And
then it's very interesting.
You've got to ask, well, why is that there? You know, yep. why would that be in your head? You know, why is that just an important thing that evolved? You know, what kind of selective pressures were on that? But
well, since you bring it up, we have to segue into that a little bit just to finish that point. I've actually had religious people argue that it's that God put it there because he wanted us to believe
in
him.
Right.
But from a evolutionary biology point of view, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that human beings are hardwired and our closest relatives, like chimpanzees, are hardwired to surrender a bit of our will and ourselves to higher authority, whether that's just the leader of the pack or the leader of the tribe, and that even to the point of sacrificing ourselves for the greater good of our something bigger than us, our family, our tribe, our people.
For societal cohesion, right? So that the community is more integrated.
That kind of altruism, sacrificing yourself for the greater good of your relations, actually carries with it an evolutionary advantage in terms of passing more copies of your own genes on to future generations. So you don't have to hypothesize that, you know, God put that in our brains, that there are, you know, reasonable hypotheses about what evolutionarily why something like that would have evolved. And then we give it cultural context. You know, every culture gives it a slightly different context, but, you know, there are some sort of common themes in terms of the religious context that people give the basic, you know, hardwiring sense that there's something bigger than us that we are part of. Anyway, back to science or fiction. So, item number one, magician Harry Houdini had a collagen disorder that made him unusually flexible, aiding in his escape artistry. Number two, remember, comment on them after we're done with all three. Number two, Adolf Hitler suffered from a severe form of Parkinson's disease that made him mentally rigid and inflexible. And item number three, Vincent van Gogh suffered from an inner ear disorder that gave him persistent ringing in the ear, resulting in him famously cutting off his ear. Those are the three.
Ooh.
Okay.
Pass.
I'll start, I guess.
All right, Bob, go ahead.
Well, Hitler and Parkinson's, I have heard about that. You could see it in some of his speeches. You can see a tremor in the hand, and if you study his behavior later in the war, you could see, you know, how rigid he was in his thinking. So I think that's pretty well supported. Van Gogh and his ear ringing, it sounds like Meniere's disease to me. And from my mother has had that. And from what she says, it's pretty annoying. I could see someone just going nuts and just lopping off their ear. That makes more sense than the first one. Houdini having a collagen disorder. Now I could see, you know, maybe if it was tendons and ligaments or something else, but I don't think a collagen disorder would give you hyperflexibility. So I'm going to say that one is false.
Okay. Who wants to go next? Well, I'll say for the record, not to try to influence your choice, that people who have collagen disorders are hyperflexible.
I have a collagen disorder, don't I?
You have the opposite, though.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, I have a collagen disorder that made me rigid.
Yeah, but well, it's more of a fibroblast disorder, but...
that's exactly what I was thinking. I
mean, you've probably seen pictures of like the guys in the sideshow freak shows who like could bend their arms all in half and put their arms behind their head. Are extremely flexible. The collagen's not just in the skin, Bob. It's a protein that's a major structural protein in all ligaments, tendons, and supporting structures and everything. So that aspect of it. I mean, I'm not telling you that he had. I'm just saying that the people with collagen disorders are actually. Are hyperflexible.
Okay.
I happen to agree with Bob. The first one I think is the made up one.
Okay.
About the college.
Two votes for Harry Houdini.
Yeah. I'm gonna go with Van Gogh. I don't think he cut his ear off because it was ringing.
Okay.
I think his problems were deeper than that.
Let me add a little more then. I do remember reading something about Houdini being able to dislocate his shoulder at will. Which helped him get out of straitjackets, which, as you can imagine,
you're trying
be
to talk yourself out of your answer.
A great A. No, I'm just trying to. no, I'm just trying to think of another tack here. I think.
You already gave your answer. You're done.
No, so Steven? So yeah, I still think it's false. I Just because you can dislocate your shoulder, well, I don't necessarily think it has to be a collagen disorder, but
right.
I'm still going with it, I guess.
Okay. Right. Well, you all agree that Adolf Hitler had Parkinson's disease.
We do. Yeah.
Jawohl.
He had something going on there. You know.
That is, in fact, true.
And yeah, he was stiff, and there was other things.
Very well established. Yeah. There's historical footage of him with a clear Parkinsonian tremor in his hands. Interestingly, the propaganda guys for Hitler were very good, very thorough at eliminating any footage of him showing his Parkinsonism. But a couple, of strips of film did slip into his
The later ones.
Right.
And, there have been some good articles written sort of examining his personality and his decision-making process, and it does reflect a form of Parkinson's that it does result in this sort of obsessive, rigid adherence to courses of action, inability to change your mind or change your course of action. Which
thank goodness.
And it's that kind of inflexibility that ultimately doomed, Hitler at the end. That and the A-bomb. But and eventually we would have defeated him, even if he didn't go crazy, essentially, and kill off his generals and remain.
He didn't listen.
Persistently
to his
followed, insane.
Main thing is he didn't listen to them. He made his own military decisions.
Right.
Very often against the will of his generals.
And there was a lot of paranoia. He did kill off a lot of his senior, people because of he was afraid that they were
not like Stalin.
And they were, and they did. They did have assassinations.
Not like Stalin. Stalin killed a lot more senior generals than Hitler ever thought
he
about
did.
Killing.
But it's interesting to think of how much the course of history was influenced by a disease.
True.
Yeah.
What would have happened if Hitler, didn't have that disorder?
Right.
We'll never know, but it's interesting to think about. Okay, so let's go on to number three, Vincent van Gogh. In fact, there have been several hypotheses about van Gogh. I think the most common public story is that he was hearing voices, that he basically went a little psychotic or crazy. But there have been at least one good article published in the neurological literature reviewing his writings, where he pretty clearly describes a ringing in the ear and that basically driving him to distraction, driving him crazy, and which probably was Meniere's disease, Bob. That was, I think, probably the correct diagnosis, although, again, that much is a little bit of speculation. And he did cut off his ear, probably in a misguided attempt to stop the ringing in his ear. Of course, it didn't work.
But he had a lot of other things going on, like I said.
Yeah, he was nutty.
He was nutty.
You're right, he was nutty. And that's why it was so easy to think that he was just psychotic. But
right.
In fact, the cutting off of his ear was probably in response to the tinnitus, the ringing in the ears that he described in his writings. The one about Harry Houdini I made up. Now, a lot of that, Bob, was based upon the rumor that he could dislocate his shoulder at will. And some people, there is a rumor, kind of the mythology of Houdini does also include the fact that he was really incredibly flexible. It's all BS, actually. I could not find any verification of that. In fact, his escape artistry was largely trickery. I mean, it was illusion.
A lot of it
certainly, he was extremely skilled and talented, and could do things that were not mere illusion, that actually required some physical skill. But in essence, most of what he did was escape artist trickery, the same kind of thing that Penn and Teller do on stage today.
So you're saying he could not, there's no evidence that he could dislocate his shoulder at will.
That's
right. There's nothing to support that, okay.
And, again, these kind of myths that's kind of the mystique of the magician, that they're using more difficult, arcane, or fantastical techniques than they really are, when in fact they're just cheating. They're doing something that anyone can learn how to do, and maybe it requires some practice and manual dexterity, but no superhuman feats. But if you think they're doing their trick through some kind of superhuman or extraordinary feat, you won't look for the simple cheat as much.
Right. I mean, I remember one story. I have no evidence to back it up, but I did read in somewhere years ago that one of his famous escapes was from a London prison. And it turned out that in all the hubbub and the activity, they did not lock his
cage.
Jail cell, yeah. And he just kind of just opened it up, and there was no, it wasn't even any trickery involved in that. Just, you know, sheer stupidity on their part. Now, again, I'm not, I don't have any evidence to back that up, but my memory seems reliable.
Yeah, well, that was that wasn't part of the movie, the Hollywood version of Houdini. They just left out how he actually escaped from the prison.
The best thing about Houdini is the fact that after his mother died and he went to all those physical seances in his day, he then became a great debunker. And, boy, debunked them mercilessly because they didn't deliver on his mother.
He figured out their tricks. He knew exactly what they were doing.
And they didn't deliver.
He became very, very apparently upset about it and wanted to do something to get back at these.
Well, actually, Perry, I think that, again, is a common myth that he initially interacted with the spiritualists because he was looking to contact his mother and then became disillusioned when they failed. In fact, that was never the case.
What?
He was an atheist. He never believed in life after death, never pursued spiritualists. He was angry at the spiritualists because they were using his escape artist tricks to convince people that there were, you know, metaphysical happenings. So, like, during a seance, when the lights were out, they would, you know, and apparently they were tied to the chair or they were in a closet or something. They would use escape artist tricks in order to get out or escape or free a limb or whatever, and then create the manifestations, the bell ringing or the rapping or whatever.
Cracking their knuckles.
That was, you know, the famous sisters who were cracking their knuckles. But he knew that they were faking because he was a magician. They were using his tricks. They were using the standard trickery of the escape artist, you know, magician culture to convince people that they were performing miracles. That's why he was angry.
He never went to a seance to contact his mother?
That was Hollywood. Never. That's not part of the
That was Tony Curtis, Perry.
That was Tony Curtis.
Tony Curtis.
But and same thing with, you know, when he died, he and his wife had that you know, secret password and everything.
The
Rosebud.
The Rosebud. Of course, Hollywood changed that too to make it seem like it actually came out. But that was just another way, like a final way of debunking the spiritualist. And in fact, he was appointed as chairman of the committee to investigate spiritualists by Scientific American. This was back in the day when Scientific American really was the skeptical debunking organization. You know, now there's a dedicated skeptical movement, and Scientific American is still, you know, closely allied with that tradition. In fact, they're the only popular science journal that has a regular skeptical column in it. But, you know, back in the day of Houdini, they were it, and they set about to debunk the spiritualists, and Houdini was the one who showed them how to do it. He basically filled the same role at that time that James Randi does today. Randi's a magician. He knows he got into this because he saw faith healers using the same tricks that he was learning about right out of the magician books, and realized that they were using it to pretend to bilk money from people and to pretend that they were performing miracles. That's often why magicians like Randi, Houdini, Penn and Teller make very good skeptics. In fact, I just read an article. I'm not sure if one of you guys sent it to me, basically saying that magicians have a well-developed sense of human psychology, of how people believe and how they deceive themselves. Of course they do. It's their stock and trade.
That's right.
So recently, there has been an article published by a man called Robert Sarmast, claiming to have found Atlantis. Evan, I believe you sent me this piece. Can you tell us a little bit something about this?
I did. The source for this is the Financial Mirror, which is the island of Cyprus's leading business newspaper, according to their website. Despite that, I continued to read the article regarding this, and Robert Sarmast is he's a U.S. citizen. He had a career in architecture. That's his background and passion for ancient history, mythology, and lost civilizations, and so forth. And According to this, he has found something very interesting off the southeast coast of Cyprus, in the Mediterranean Sea, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll read from the article here that it was no coincidence that his team discovered a 3-kilometer-long straight wall intersected at right angles by another wall. This is 1.5 kilometers below sea level, 80 kilometers off the coast of Cyprus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this fellow has been looking for Atlantis for, well, from what I could tell, many, many years. He seems to be very impassioned about this. He is pulling out all stops to try and find some shred of evidence that would play to his preconceived notion that the Great Society of Atlantis did exist 11,000 years ago and so forth. We've all heard the story of the great lost civilization and continent of Atlantis. And here's what the article continues to say. He apparently adds that this will silence any remaining skepticism about his longstanding claims that modern Cyprus is the remains of a much larger and now partly sunken mass, which fits Plato's description of the ancient lands of Atlantis. So he thinks he's found the evidence, this wall that is off the coast of Cyprus under the water.
I'm convinced.
I'm silenced.
I shall forever be silent on this topic. There's nothing
more to say.
Well, the fact that this is endorsed by the Cyprus Tourism Organization, you know, may have something to do with their enthusiasm for these claims. And also, he's looking, apparently, partnering with the TMC Entertainment Group out of Los Angeles to undertake a 2-hour documentary to, you know, finance his next expedition. So, you know, this guy's a self-promoter, you know, and there are local financial interests involved. Does he really think that there's an entire city under the Mediterranean and we haven't found it?
Boy, you know,
that's hardly out in the depths of the Atlantic. I mean, the Mediterranean Sea is pretty well mapped.
Well, and that's where anyone who's familiar with the origins, the first mention of Atlantis, knows that it goes back to Plato and to two of his works, Timaeus and Critias, in which essentially Plato creates an example for his class so that he can talk further about what a great society is. And he invents a conversation that occurred between Timaeus and Critias, two people that apparently didn't even live at the same time in real history.
Right.
They lived 150 years apart from each other.
Right.
But Plato just put them together so he could make his point about
the
Republic.
Yeah, it's like writing about a fictitious conversation between Einstein and Galileo.
Right. That's exactly correct.
And then somebody later thinking that it was meant to be an historically accurate document.
Exactly. Exactly. Where the entire story itself is made up, and yet this myth has survived since 370 BC.
Right.
There's
a lot of mythology surrounding Atlantis that's inaccurate. I mean, if you go back to Plato's original mention, I think there's sort of the modern Atlantis myth is that Atlantis was this extremely advanced utopian society. In fact, Plato did not use Atlantis as an example of a utopian society. He used it as an example of an evil empire. The utopian society, in his example,
Athens.
Athens was the shining city on the hill, and then these invaders from this evil empire out there in Atlantis were the ones that were threatening Athens. But the modern mythology, made up Atlantis mythology, sort of reversed all of that and now reinterprets Atlantis as the utopian society. But also, Plato's description of Atlantis was as beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which is what separates the Mediterranean Sea from the Atlantic Ocean.
The Straits of Gibraltar.
Right. So that would put it outside of the Mediterranean.
Correct.
As opposed to Sarmast, who's now saying that it's within the Mediterranean. If Plato were meant to be accurate, we don't think he did. You know, the scholars think that by saying beyond the Pillars of Hercules is just a poetic way of saying really far away. You know, beyond our local geography, beyond anything you would recognize. Because, you know, at that time, beyond the Atlantic Ocean basically was just the edges of the Earth. I mean, it was just out there. It was beyond what was mapped. So it's just like saying really, really far away.
The average depth of the Mediterranean is about 4,700 feet. The guy thinks the whole city is down there at the bottom. That's, you know.
Yeah.
That's the average.
Well, the thing is, it's a pretty well-trodden, you know,
it is.
Stretch of sea. It's not like it's in there's some trench in the middle of the Atlantic that, you know, it could be missed. We could sonar map and et cetera. I mean, I think if there were a city hiding under there, we'd know about it. Also, there are a lot of legitimate Greek, you know, ruins in the Mediterranean. A lot of there's a lot of serious archaeology going on in the area. So again, it wouldn't be surprising if they did, you know, find some Greek archaeological ruins. But the other thing that's interesting about Sarmast's claims is that he's basing his discovery on sonar. Now, sonar is just infamous, you know, for being misinterpreted in this way, because you get, you know, sonar images produce, you know, these sort of vague blob-like images that are really good for prompting the imagination. It's like an inkblot test. I mean, you can basically see whatever it is you want to see. It reminds me of the investigators who used sonar to look for Nessie, you know, in Loch Ness.
Right.
And they came, of course, you know, they found what they were looking for. They had these blurry sonar images of a vague outline that they said, well, here's a fin and here's a piece
like
of
the
neck.
Bigfoot pictures?
Well,
just like the ghost pictures and alien pictures and everything.
But
that's just pareidolia, where you're seeing an identifiable, distinct image in just randomness. Like
pattern
recognition. The canals of Mars are another great
example. A face in the clouds.
Right.
The face on Mars is a good example. But the sonar is just custom made for this, because you could just look at reams and reams and reams of sonar until you see a vague shape that you can interpret as being whatever it is you were looking for. And so I think it's humorous that this guy thinks he's finding stuff with sonar that, you know, more sophisticated methods have not found.
He describes a hill that he discovered using this sonar technology, and I'll quote him here. The hill as a whole basically looks like a walled hillside territory, and this hillside territory matches Plato's description of the Acropolis Hill with perfect precision. Even the dimensions are exactly perfect. So if all these things are coincidental, I mean, we have the world's greatest coincidence going on.
Yeah,
hardly.
Thank you, Mr. Sarmast.
It's also, historians agree that, you know, serious historians, that Plato was not making a factual historical claim. First of all, how would Plato, of all people, know about some ancient island society that lived thousands of years before him? How did this information magically come to him? It certainly was not the common belief of the time. He was not an investigative archaeologist or anything. And if he were making that claim, it would have sparked quite a bit of controversy at his time, contemporary to him. And no one batted an eyebrow, because everyone understood that it was just a made-up example for his morality story. So it's just silly. And a lot of people also make the false connection. They say, well, they found Troy, you know, initially they thought that Troy was a legendary or fictitious city, and then the ruins of Troy were found, but they missed the fact that Troy was written about by Homer, not Plato, who was writing about actual mythology or stories of the time. Plato is a philosopher that was writing a hypothetical story to make some certain philosophical points, and basically was saying a long time ago, on an island far, far away, there was this evil empire.
That's right. Our good friend Dr. Kenny Fader likens it to the Star Wars story. And he says to, you know, in which the small rebellion overthrows the evil supergalactic empire. That's effectively the story of Atlantis, but there's about as much there's equal proof that Star Wars is real, that the story of Atlantis is real. They're fiction. They're works of fiction. It's just so interesting how a small detail out of a piece of fiction like that Plato came up with totally blossomed into this myth that has just really not only survived the ages, but it's gained momentum.
There's certainly something about it that has a common appeal. I guess the idea of this ancient, advanced civilization just is romantic. It's very romantic, and people are drawn to it. It's also a really fun touchstone to have as a skeptic, because it's so demonstrably wrong that it's just wonderful when psychics and channelers and mediums claim to have been from Atlantis or to talk to people from Atlantis. Like, I'm reminded of Ramtha, you know, this woman, Jay-Z Knight, who bilks money from people by claiming to be channeling the spirit of a 30,000-year-old man from Atlantis. Well, right there, you know she's full of it. I mean, not that we needed that tidbit, but it just always adds a nice little extra demonstrable piece of BS to the claims of lots of psychics and mediums. I believe Edgar Casey, wasn't there some Atlantis connection with him as well? Edgar Casey was, you know, the so-called sleeping prophet who would go into trances and
trances, he would tend to, I guess, describe the technology that the folks of Atlantis had at the time, and apparently it was pretty similar to the technology of Edgar Casey's time,
right?
The 1920s and the 1930s.
He wasn't describing technology that we would recognize,
right? And funny, no one prior to Edgar Casey mentioned anything about the technology,
right?
Such as flying ships and electricity. Prior to those actual real discoveries,
prior to them already being part of the culture, which is, you know, that brings up an interesting theme when you're talking either about Atlantean technology or the UFO mythology. It always follows the culture of the time, and you can sort of see how it's a cultural mythology. There's never the introduction of something which is clearly outside of the context of the contemporary culture. In other words, there's never the introduction of any new technology, new scientific information, new facts that were not previously known. It's always this well-documented cultural continuity. And when you look back, especially at like 40 or 50 years ago, that's a good time. You look back 40 or 50 years ago, to what the UFO people were saying, it seems really quaint and silly to us, and in fact reflects what we think of as campy 1950s science fiction movies, because that was the culture. But to them, you know, women from Venus was like a plausible idea. To us, it seems silly, but that's what the UFO people were saying back then.
And 50 years from now, they'll be saying the same thing about our time period.
Yeah, about those quaint little gray aliens that everybody claimed that they were being abducted by. Well, and speaking of alien abductions, there was a book published recently by author Susan Clancy called Abducted: How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens. Bob, I know you've heard about this.
Yeah, this book seems very interesting to me. I've written a few things about some of the things that she touches upon. And so I've read the review, and it seems very interesting. I can't wait till it comes out in October. But Dr. Clancy, just to give you a synopsis of what she's saying here, is that she's a psychologist at Harvard, and this book...
John Mack's alma mater, right? John Mack is a psychiatrist who believed that a number of his patients were the victims of abductions. And although his colleagues generally believe that he essentially just got caught up in their own delusions and was not using scientific rigor.
I hope he reads this
Yeah,
book.
So he was a Harvard man. He was from Harvard. Well, he's not going to read it because he's dead.
Right.
Okay.
Deceased.
He was hit by a car in England, I think London.
Really? Mack died?
Yeah, John Mack was killed by a car.
Early reports.
This was a year
ago. One, 2 years ago?
Oh, it was a year ago. It was a year ago.
It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
Early reports said the car was driven by an alien.
Right.
But they have since been disproved. they have since been dispelled, no doubt by skeptical organizations.
To continue, Dr. Clancy interviewed dozens of people that claimed to have been abducted, and as part of a series of memory tests that she was running, part of the reason for this was that the reason why she focused on abduction memories was to explain... she's interested in the psychology of experiences that transform people, and she basically wants to know just more about why do people believe these weird things. So that was kind of her impetus in this, I believe. And she touches on a lot of things that should be of interest to skeptical thinkers. So many areas. Primarily, she hits on sleep paralysis, which is very important. Sleep paralysis is I think, and it's widely held, I believe, by a lot of skeptics, that sleep paralysis is the cause of a lot of these paranormal events that people ascribe to ghosts or alien abductions or things like that. And sleep paralysis is essentially an event that happens while you're in REM sleep, rapid eye movement, and while you're dreaming, your body paralyzes you, the motor neurons in your brain inhibits any movement except for your eyes, of course, to prevent you from acting out your dreams, which you would do if you were not paralyzed. And they've actually done studies on these bizarre studies on cats where they somehow fried the center of the brain, the part of the brain that inhibits motor movement during sleep, and cats would, while they're asleep, act out their dreams.
Do you know the name of that the nucleus that they lesion to do that?
Yeah, the yes.
The locus ceruleus in the brainstem.
Okay, yeah.
It's a little trivia for you guys.
I used to know that. I hate when I forget stuff like that. But so it's during sleep. Sleep paralysis occurs during these events when you wake up from a dream. Another word for that is waking dream. And during these events, you feel paralyzed, but you're kind of still in this pseudo dream state. In that state, lots of bizarre things can happen because you're essentially dreaming while you're awake. And this is what happens to a lot of these people that are abducted. This is what she believes and what her studies kind of point to, that this is a major contributing factor to this. And,
yeah, we've spoken about that before in the Skeptic's Guide. I believe I spoke about the fact that I've actually had waking dreams.
Oh, yes.
Produced by extreme sleep deprivation, so I could describe them firsthand. It's very, very weird, powerful experiences, so it's worthy of study. Also, just of note, while we're on the topic of sleep paralysis, Whitley Strieber, who is a science fiction writer who was sort of promoting the idea that he was abducted by aliens.
Well, what was his famous book? I forget the title.
Communion.
Communion.
He, in one of his subsequent books, basically just recounted the stories of hundreds of people with abduction tales. And those stories were reviewed by, I believe it was Joe Nickel who wrote, and Jim Baker, who is a psychologist, reviewed all of the accounts, and fully 70% of them fit really well into the description of a waking dream. So by that survey, we're talking about 70% of the abduction phenomenon being explainable on the basis of this neurological phenomenon, this sleep paralysis or waking dream.
Well, a lot of people say, well, how come these people are seeing aliens? And that's purely cultural.
Right.
Centuries ago, people were still people. People still had these waking dreams, or they would experience hypnagogia, is another term for it. And they, of course, didn't see aliens, because nobody even thought of aliens back then. They would see demons called succubi and these witches that would sit on your chest and prevent you from breathing and things.
And I believe didn't the Scandinavians have a legend about the sea hag who would sit on your chest and
right.
suck away your energy? And it was basically the same experience, just with a different cultural icon.
Right. Every culture actually has some mention of it. I think in Japan,
really, what did the Inuit culture have?
Wasn't it some big
like the Wendigo?
The Wendigo? I was challenging you, Bob.
Threw
you
it
said
out
culture.
There.
Just threw it and figured.
Okay.
Throw out an obscure culture and see if you knew what they had.
Okay, many cultures. Many
we'll
cultures
we'll look that up and see if we can figure out what the Inuit mythology that fits waking dreams might have been.
Japan had one, and I think the name of the being that they ascribed it to was something like Zanzibar or something that sounds like that. But I literally read like five or six cultures that all have very similar ideas on this weird being that would enter your room and cause these bizarre experiences to happen. And another interesting thing that Dr. Clancy found out that was a lot of these people that had these so-called abduction experiences already have some interest in the paranormal or the possibility of extraterrestrial visitors. So they were prone to believe in something bizarre like this. And a lot of times these people would try to find some deeper meaning in this and try to find out what really happened, and they would go to a therapist. And a lot of these therapists use hypnosis or even chemicals to induce these highly suggestive states. And we know that in these states, confabulation can occur where you just kind of stream of consciousness create these stories that you come to believe as true memories and are in fact indistinguishable from real memories. And
right.
Bam, you've got your false memory syndrome and things that it's really a shame that these therapists aren't more savvy as to actually what they're doing. They're creating these memories and
it's malpractice. It's total incompetence. You basically have a professional, who's professing to have some expertise and to be helping people, and what they're basically doing is using a discredited method which is known to create false memories, known to essentially create confabulation. And then they put people in this state, they ask suggestive questions, and the standard abduction scenario emerges under hypnosis. They then convince these people they've been abducted. It becomes one more piece of evidence, and for those people, investigators who collect it, it becomes part of the mythology. And it's really just a BS machine. I mean, they're just creating these false stories. I mean, basically, it is no different than the therapists who were using coercive and unprofessional techniques to convince young women with eating disorders that they were raped and had repressed memories. It's the same thing. So it's hypnosis and abduction scenario, but it's blatant incompetence in my opinion. No excuse for it.
One final point here to drive it home. Dr. Clancy did a study in 2002 with Richard McNally, and did another test on these people that had abduction memories, and she looks like she had some controls as well, people who did not have any abduction memories. And she did a word association test where she would list, here's five words, and then a few minutes later she would say, well, was this word on the list and was this word on the list? And she would throw a related word that was not on the list, like sugar, candy, sour, bitter. And then she would say, was the word sweet on the list? And the people that had abduction memories were more likely than non-abducted people to actually have a memory that sweet was indeed on the list when in fact it wasn't. So these people are prone to associate the event with something really supernatural, and to actually form false memories themselves.
And that you could take that one step further, and I think that this the psychologist, Jim Baker wrote, reviewing a lot of the recorded abduction tales, believes these people are not just prone to this sort of confabulation, but also what he calls fantasy prone. Now, a fantasy prone personality type is someone who was more likely to have imaginary friends when they were children, to have had visions, to believe in a host of paranormal things, to believe that they have seen or experienced ghosts or spirits. A lot of these things go hand in hand. Interestingly, we had a lecture a year ago by a neurologist, Terence Hines, who is doing some very interesting work where, he believes he may have uncovered an actual, neurological hardwiring difference in some people who actually have the ability to, would it be a good way to describe it? I think, turn off their reality testing, hardware in their brain to actually, when fantasizing about something, to actually inhibit that part of their brain that would tell them that it's not real. To actually,
it's kind of like a waking dream, in a sense.
To actually believe it. No, it's actually, I wouldn't make that analogy. I think it's a different phenomenon, because waking dream really is a fusion between two different states, a waking state and a sleeping state. This is a pure waking state, but there are certain hardware in our brain that we can't inhibit. For example, the experiment that he did was, if you see a word in a language that you can speak and can read, you can't inhibit your ability to read that word. And that in testing comes out as a certain delay in your response time. So if you're shown flashcards with the word red written in green ink, and you're told to say the color of the ink, to say green, it takes you a fraction of a second to inhibit your hardwiring tendency to say the word red, the word that the letters spell out. If it's written in a language that you don't read, that delay's not there. And, in fact, this test has reliably been used to sniff out spies. So you can give a suspected Russian spy that test using Russian words, and if they can speak Russian, there'll be a delay. And if they don't speak Russian, there won't be a delay. For example. And until recently, no one has ever been able to create research conditions in which that delay went away. It didn't seem that human beings had the ability to suppress that hardwiring loop. That processing just has to happen. Until, you know, Hines and I think some of his colleagues, and this is not, I don't think this has yet been published and peer-reviewed, but basically what he is finding is that in a certain percentage of the population, 2-3% of the population, under hypnosis, they can make that effect go away, which suggests that their brains are actually hardwired differently and that they have the ability to inhibit certain, you know, certain pathways that most people cannot. It would be interesting to see if these people are also excessively fantasy-prone. So we may, in a small subset of people, we may actually be dealing with people whose brains are literally wired differently than the rest of us. Although that, in addition to that, there are people who do not have this effect, but are probably just predisposed to vivid fantasies to the point where they actually take on a reality or a life of their own.
Well, Steve, you're a neurologist. What do you think the likelihood is of a subset of people who are just wired differently?
Well, his research is very compelling. This test has been used for decades. It's a very standardized, well-recognized test. You know, psychologists know how to carry it out reliably. The results are very reproducible and very reliable. And if you can reproducibly make that effect go away, that means something. That is a genuine discovery. So I think that that's very compelling.
What would your hypothesis be as to how that subset was created, why it exists?
Well, it's just random variation. Every human trait, every, you know, trait in any species varies on a bell curve, and there are subsets and subpopulations. So our hard wiring, I'm sure, varies in every way it's possible to vary. And they have, you know, just an alternate, you know, either one part of the brain is more dominant than another part, or there is some kind of pathway that exists that enables them to inhibit this processing loop.
It could be very subtle. I mean, it doesn't have to be this major difference. It could be a very subtle difference.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, and it would have to be. This experiment is designed to look at a very subtle phenomenon.
Steve, right. you mentioned that these people have a way of you know, turning off reality testing, and the point I tried to insert there was that it's similar to, you know, maybe not a waking dream, but when you are in fact dreaming and a pink elephant walks in front of you, you don't think, "What, my, that's quite odd." You don't think that because your reality testing is kind of shut down. I mean, your frontal lobe, isn't your frontal lobe pretty much very quiescent at that point, and that's one of the reasons why it doesn't seem out of place for you to have a, you know, a pink elephant trot by you.
Yeah, that much is true, and it's interesting. So I mean, the dream state is actually a different state of consciousness than the waking state. Different parts of your brain are active when you're dreaming. It's you know, all the parts of your brain that are active when you're awake are active. I mean, let me say that the other way. When you're awake, all the parts of your brain are active. When you're sleeping, some of the parts of your brain are not active.
And some are very active.
And those parts of the brain have to do with certain dominant hemisphere functions like reading. It's very difficult to read while you're asleep. And also the mechanisms
really?
Of reality testing. Yeah, try that if you're ever.
I've tried it many times.
Think of it while you're dreaming. That it's really hard to actually read while you're dreaming.
I mean, many times I've had lucid dreams where you actually wake up in your dream and you realize, hey, I'm in bed asleep right now, and everything that I see and experience is a creation of my mind. And it's a very interesting experience. I recommend it. Steve, I believe you've actually had
I've had them, yeah. Most people, I think, have had basically you realize that you're dreaming while you're dreaming. And what happens there, what happens there is simply that your reality testing kicks in enough for you to realize that you're dreaming. But it's a very unstable state. It's very unstable. Your tendency
is
either
to maintain.
Right, you'll either fully wake up or you'll dream that you wake up, which basically means that you lose the lucidity. You again lose the ability to realize that you're dreaming.
You've got to really be careful and not get too overexcited, which can happen when you're in an environment that you have a lot of control over or some sort of control, like, you know, flying, making people appear, you know, getting naked with movie stars. You know, it's hard not to get excited. And when you do get excited, invariably you wake up or you dream you wake up and you're like, damn. But, of course, I lost the point I was trying to make.
Okay. You got off about naked movie stars, Bob. Why don't you go along that train?
That's enough to distract anyone.
Reading.
And one of the triggers, you know, you try to develop these triggers, you know, to induce lucidity in your dream, and you do a dream test, and there's various things you could do. You can jump up in the air, and if you could make yourself fall slightly more slower or faster than physics dictates you should fall, then that's a pretty good clue that you are in fact dreaming, because there's no way you're going to be able to, you know, do that in real life.
Yeah, there's just ways to trigger your reality testing,
and the best way to do it is to read something. Get anything, a poster, a book, open the book up, look at some words, turn away, and then look back at the writing, and invariably the text will be different. It's completely different. So that probably ties into what you were saying, Steve, where it's hard to read in a dream.
Right.
Well, the words are changing around all the time, which would make it very difficult to dream, to read.
It's interesting. I mean, it's because we're not used to our brains seamlessly create this illusion of the mind and the self for us, that it's difficult to think about the fact that there are parts of our brain that are responsible for some specific functions like reality testing. And most people probably aren't aware of the fact that there's a part of our brain that in fact does that. And part of the reason that we know that it does that is because it can get turned off. And then when it gets turned off, it can create psychosis in the waking state, or it can, you know, it's a normal part of the dream state where fantastical, bizarre things happen, and they make sense to you in the dream because the part of your brain that should tell you that doesn't make sense is not functioning at the time.
Right.
It's asleep. That part of your brain's asleep.
How many times do you wake up and you say, what the hell was I thinking, you know?
Yeah.
How could I not possibly imagine that was okay?
Right. Because it's a different state of awareness that's produced by a different, you know, set of parts of your brain working together.
Right. But just a quick aside on the lucid dreaming, I really recommend that. Look up lucid dreaming on the internet, and it's really a fascinating experience. It's bizarre in that once you become lucid in the dream, the dream world looks even more realistic than you could imagine. I remember, you know, walking around looking at my brother in my dream thinking, wow, this is just a creation of my mind, and it's just so realistic. You know, I even, like, knocked on a piece of wood and listened to the echo and just marveled at the fidelity of the experience. It was very, very cool.
It's interesting. I wonder what that says about the future of virtual reality when we can essentially plug experiences into our brain. Will they be indistinguishable from real reality? And I think the suggestion
Absolutely.
Is that they will be. I mean, how your brain, if you make those neurons fire artificially versus through sensory input, the brain doesn't know the difference. Those neurons fire. It creates a very believable experience to you.
Well, reality is a construct. Your mind is building, creates your reality. And, I mean, one aspect of perception, vision, is an incredible construct. It's you know, vision is a creation. It's not a tape recorder passively recording what's going on. Your mind creates, you know, create your visual world for you to such a degree. I once saw a picture of what the image on your retina really looks like, and it was this small, upside down, kind of indistinct, you know, blurry image. You know, the tiny center of it was somewhat more in focus than the other parts, but you'd be amazed at what a paltry thing it was, and your mind takes that and creates this, you know, magnificent three-dimensional world from these two little, you know, postage stamp size two-dimensional images, and it's just amazing what it does.
Right.
What the
there's
mind
a lot,
creates
there's a lot
that.
Of processing going on to create the illusion of depth and contrast and things like that. And that's the source of all visual optical illusions. Optical illusions are basically ways of tricking that processing into thinking that there's depth when there isn't, or contrast when there isn't, whatever. So that taking advantage of the methods that the brain uses to process that information and create the again the illusion of three-dimensionality, et cetera.
And I read an article about this gentleman who was blind for most of his life and was given sight through some operation. And you'd think, wow, he's got his vision back. Great for him. But actually, it was actually a terrible thing for him because he did not – his brain did not have to process visual images his whole life. It really wasn't up to the task.
Well, it never developed it.
It never developed. I kind of forget if it was he had a few years of a vision.
But not enough. Your optical cortex only develops in response to visual stimuli. So if you're blind from birth, the seeing part of your brain never develops, and then there's nothing that could be done to make you not blind.
But he must have had some years of vision because he did have some sort of vision, but it was this kind of chaotic thing that it was not a pleasant experience for him. But surprisingly, he was immune to illusions because his brain wasn't constructing this nice visual reality for him.
It wasn't doing the processing, so
there was no processing to trick because the processing just wasn't really quite there for him.
But the downside was the vision wasn't very useful for him.
No.
It was just a sort of a unprocessed chaos of signals that the brain didn't know how to deal with.
I think it would be cool to actually experience that for a brief time to see what does this raw image look like, and then just to see, oh wow, look at all this noise and static and stuff flowing around there and I think you could better appreciate what your visual centers of your brain create for you.
Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Just to say once again, that book by Susan Clancy is Abducted: How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens, from Harvard University Press. Looks like it's going to be a good read. Bobby said it's coming out in October. Is that what you read? So that definitely look forward to getting that book when it comes out. Well, thank you again for joining us this week on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Perry, Bob, Evan, thanks for joining me.
Our pleasure.
Excellent. We'll see you next week.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information on this and other episodes, see our website at www.thenes.com.